in the Old Testament, the Old Testament prophets look forward to someone who is going to be called Emmanuel. And that's out of Isaiah 7 that we just talked about. This person was also described as the Rod of Jesse. That's from Isaiah chapter 11. The person was also described as the Key of David. That's from Isaiah chapter 22. And the person was also described as the Dayspring from on high, which is in Luke chapter 1. So over the next four Sundays leading up to Christmas, we're going to use the Christmas carol, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, to guide us in looking at these four major titles that are given to Jesus at his first coming. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about this Christmas carol, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, which we actually sang last week. And it happens to be probably my favorite Christmas carol, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. That carol was written about 1,200 years ago by a monk. And the monk was inspired by the verses in Luke chapter 1 leading up to the birth of Christ. And these verses from Luke 1:46 through 1:56 are the verses that Mary speaks about what God is going to do. It's called Mary's Magnificat. And those verses, he took those and he summarized them and he put them into lyric, this monk did. Then years later, nuns in a French convent took a tune and applied it to that lyric. And the tune that they used was from a funeral procession. So they took that, they put it with the lyric, and then after that, John Neal, who was an Anglican priest, discovered this, and he translated it into English, and that's how we got our hymn, our Christmas carol, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And it is a beautiful carol that focuses in on these four major titles that are given to Jesus. And this morning, we're going to look at Isaiah chapter 7, which is about Jesus being called Emmanuel, which is the Hebrew word for God with us. So when we look at this, I want to just give you a background to this Isaiah 7, because when you hear Emmanuel, you usually just, you know, read this one verse, but there's quite a bit of background that has a lot of meaning for Christmas for us this morning. For the first time in the history of Israel, Jerusalem, the major city of Israel, came under siege, and there were two powerful armies that Andy was reading about that were right outside the walls of Jerusalem, and they were ready to take Jerusalem apart. The two armies was Rezin, king of Syria, and then Pekah, who was the king of Ephraim. And they were in total control of everything around Jerusalem. And defeat was just not, it wasn't a matter of if, but when. And it was inevitable. In fact, Ahaz, the king of Jerusalem, he went out to look at the water supply in the upper pool in order to estimate, in verse 3, how much longer they had before they were going to have to either be subdued by no more water or be subdued by military might. So they were going to lose out. And with this grim forecast, Isaiah describes in verse 2, he says that they were shaking like trees of the woods moved by the wind. I mean, it was over. And it was a grim reality what was going to happen to them. So God sends Isaiah up to the pool to meet up with Ahaz. And he tells Ahaz to stop worrying, that those two huge armies outside breathing down your necks are nothing but smoldering stumps, and that they're going to be, they're not even going to exist in 65 years from now. And so there was another time when this took place. Ahaz is asked by God, God says, just ask me for a sign and I'll show you I'm going to do this. Just ask me for a sign. Please ask me for a sign and I'll give you a sign that will guarantee that I'm going to do this. And of course, you know, there was a couple other times where this happened. One was when Prophet Elisha, he was living in Dothan, and his community was surrounded by the king of Syria's army, and all the chariots were out there. You know, in ancient times, chariots were the equivalent of tanks. And, you know, Elisha's servant goes out there, he sees these tanks, chariots, and he's like, what are we going to do, prophet of God? And, you know, and Elisha, he goes out there, and he sees all of them, and he says to his servant, he says, those who are with us are greater than those who are with them. And then he prays to God. He says, God, open his eyes that he may see. And of course, he opens his servant's eyes and he looks, and then he sees the flaming chariots that are all around, you know, the little bitty tanks of the, you know, the king of Assyria. And then it happened again. Elisha, well, so what Ahaz says, he says, what am I going to do? And Isaiah tells him, ask God for a sign, and he will show you a sign, either in the depths of the sea or in the heights of heaven, verse 10. And well, Ahaz, he doesn't want to do it. And I'm going to come back to that point of what happened, because Ahab didn't want to ask God for a sign. And so what Ahaz says, he says, under the cloak of, you know, you don't ask God for signs. God says to Ahaz, okay, I'm going to give you a sign. I'm going to choose a sign for you. And he gives him the sign of the virgin birth of Jesus. So why are we looking at this text this morning? The reason why we're going to look at this text is because it describes Jesus' birth. If you go to Matthew chapter 1, Matthew says that the birth of Jesus fulfilled Isaiah 7:14. He says, this event is fulfilling. It's where this he didn't use it just for illustrative purposes. He's saying that this fulfilled what Isaiah wrote about. It's a pretty momentous fulfillment. And so what we're going to look at is, if you understand Isaiah 7, then you understand the meaning of Christmas. So what can we learn from Isaiah 7, and what can we learn about the meaning of Christmas? All right, first of all, we're going to look at how Christmas means waiting on God. Secondly, we're going to look at how Christmas means trusting God over everything else. And then thirdly, we're going to talk about Christmas meaning coming into God's presence. So we're going to talk about waiting, believing, and connecting. Three very simple truths. Not so simple to apply, but three simple truths. All right, let's look at each one of these. First of all, Christmas means waiting on God. When you're faced with a problem and you're under high pressure, your natural inclination is to what? What's the guy thing to do? Fix it, right? That's what we do. We fix things. Okay, it's like a guy thing. We're into fixing. Well, what am I going to do about this? You know, or, you know, what are you going to do about this? Or someone has got to do something about this. This is why you have elections, because someone has to do something about it, right? We naturally want to take matters into our own hands. We want to figure it out. And that's why Ahaz is up there at the water supply. He's calculating. He's got his abacus out there. You know, he's thinking, how many more days, you know, do I have to go? And who do I need to cut a deal with to take care of these armies that are just outside the walls of my city? See, Ahaz is a leader, and leaders make decisions. They get things done, right? But Isaiah is telling him just the opposite. And it's just the opposite of everything inside of us. Leaders understand this phrase. Don't just stand there. Do something, right? God turned this on his head and he says, don't do something, just stand there. Now that's hard to swallow that. There is a film, a World War II film that I love. It's called U-571, if any of you have ever seen that. It's a submarine movie. It's a real, like, guys movie, and, you know, there's noise and destruction and stuff. And, you know, anyway, they're charged with finding this machine called an Enigma. And it's an encoding device, you know, that the enemy used for sending messages. And they needed to get this so that they could understand, you know, what was going on out there in the waters, and they were losing. So they go out there, and in the process of recovering this machine called the Enigma, they get attacked by an enemy sub, and the skipper gets killed, and now the executive officer becomes the skipper. And then the ship comes under attack, and he doesn't know what to do. And his crew says, what are we to do? And he says, I don't know. That was a big mistake. Because in the Navy, you never say that. And so his chief takes him aside, and he, you know, I went back. I wanted to get the exact phraseology, and this is how he said it. He says, the chief says, Skipper, a commanding officer is a mighty and terrible thing. a man to be feared and respected, all-knowing, all-powerful. Don't you dare say to the boys again, I don't know. You're the skipper now, and the skipper always knows what to do, whether he does or not. See, isn't that just, it's ingrained in us, right? The challenge of waiting on God, and here's Ahaz, is not doing something, but standing there and doing nothing. You know, God is going to do something. And here's what 1 Corinthians 2:9 says. But as it is written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. I think the older that I get, I think this is the harder thing to do. Is to be able to patiently wait and watch what God is going to do. That's that we have agendas. We have plans. We have things that we're going to do, right? And it is so difficult to watch what God is going to do. Now, how can we bring this into our lives? Because this is the first lesson of Christmas. When you're pulled into making knee-jerk moves and decisions when under pressure, it doesn't allow time to see what God is trying to do, right? Taking time, standing there, gives us time to see what God is going to do, but it goes against our very nature. Instead, we want to see what God is going to do, and that means that we have to set our agenda aside. I was reading a book, this had to be about 2 or 3 years ago. It was on leadership, and I can't even remember the name of the book, but I know it was written by Steve Sample, who was the president of, I guess he still is, of the University of Southern California. And one of the principles he said in that book, which about knocked me over, was he said he put off making a decision as long as he could until he absolutely had to make a decision. And the reason why he did that is so that he could have all of the information that he would ever need in order to make it. I mean, that is so counterintuitive, right? It's like, I want to make it right now. And that was a principle of his great leadership as president of USC. And then he gave examples of where waiting gave him as much time as he needed to make the correct decision. You know, when Jesus was born and placed in a feeding trough, he grew up in poverty. People were impatient to see what God was doing. Kings are not brought into the world and placed into a feeding trough, a manger. Instead, what conventional wisdom says this, it says that the solution to the problems of the world will not come from, well, here's what conventional wisdom says, it comes from the convention centers. It comes from the throne rooms, comes from the drawing rooms, it comes from the Oval Office, it comes from the lecture halls, it comes from the great Ivy League schools, but it does not come from slave quarters, and it does not come from little fishing boats, and it does not come from feeding troughs. That's not where you're going to find the solutions to the world's problems. Conventional wisdom says, don't just stand there, do something. And what God is saying to Ahaz is, don't do something, just stand there. He says, these two armies are going to be, they are nothing. And then he says, just ask me for a sign and I'll show it to you. And Ahaz wouldn't do it. But this is the first lesson of the meaning of Christmas, is that Christmas means not doing something, but just standing there. That's hard to do. Really hard to do. Because God is saying, be part of what I'm doing. You don't always have to be doing something. You can be part of what I am doing. All right, that's the first lesson. Secondly, Christmas means believing God. Well, of course, right? In other words, there are going to be times that we can't see past the quick fix when it's standing right in front of you. That's what we want to do. It's very difficult to believe on God when other things are battling for our heart's trust. Here's the situation. Ahaz had two armies. They're outside the walls. And his quick fix has a name. You know what his name is? Tiglath-Pileser. He's the king of Assyria. It almost sounds like a Disney character. Tiglath, right? I guess that would be Piglet. But it's Tiglath-Pileser. And he's the king of Assyria, and he's the quick fix, and he can take care of the king of Syria, and he can take care of the king of Ephraim. He's the way out, right? Make a deal with him. Cut a deal with Tiglath-Pileser. And but God, speaking through Isaiah in verse 10, he says, these two armies are like nothing. See, in verse 4, he says they're smoldering stubs. But in verse 10, he says, ask me for a sign, whether it's in the depths of the sea or in the heights of heaven, and I'll bring it about. In other words, Ahaz could have asked for the sun to stand still and the moon to stop like Joshua, and God would have done it. Ahaz could have asked for God to raise a dead person like he did through Elijah in 1 Kings 17, and God would have done it. From heaven to earth, ask me anything, I'll do it. And this is what Ahaz did. You know what Ahaz did? He said, no, I'm not going to ask you for a sign. That would be unspiritual to do that. This is God speaking to Ahaz. No, it would be unspiritual to ask you for a sign. And Ahaz basically turns God's word around on him and uses it against him to justify his disobedience. See, in Deuteronomy 6, it says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Why? Because you shall not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted him at Massah. That's right out of Deuteronomy 6. How could Ahaz be wrong? Ahaz took the high moral ground. He uses God's own words to avoid obeying God. He took a spiritual principle and he used it to disobey God. Under the pretense of obeying God, he justifies what he wants to do anyway. Now that is painful. That's an ouch right there. And when that happens, it's always, always disastrous. Ahaz, by refusing that. Okay, so what happened to Ahaz? Well, it's the story of Israel. And this is the fascinating part of Isaiah 7 that I when I was reading one of the commentaries, I think it was called the Preacher's Commentary. It was one of the commentaries I was looking at. And they said, basically the commentator said, you know, the reason why Israel went into captivity is because Ahaz wouldn't ask for this sign. They were taken captive by Assyria eventually. And this was a horrible decision Ahaz made. By not asking God for a sign, instead he cut a deal with the king of Assyria. Then his allegiance was then pledged to the idols. He had to retool the altar in Jerusalem for the new pagan gods of Assyria. And eventually God took him right out, and Assyria conquered him and took him out. What Christmas means, it means believing God and saying no to the quick fixes in our life, to the easy answers, to the most convenient, to what makes the most sense. And I want to ask you something. If you were in Ahaz's shoes and you had two armies sitting right outside the city ready to take you apart, who would you be cutting a deal with? I mean, I'm looking for the big guy. That's the king of Assyria who could do something about my issue. I'm looking to cut a deal, right? The last thing I want to be told is, no, don't do anything. Do nothing. Just stand there. The only thing you have to do is just ask me for a sign. That's so counterintuitive, that it is exactly how God works. Christmas means saying no to the quick fix. Here's Matthew, the gospel writer, and he was saying that the birth of Jesus is the answer to the issues in your life for which you are looking for the quicker fixes. In Matthew's time, what did they want? They wanted a powerful leader to throw off the boot of Roman oppression. And what did they get? They got Jesus, who didn't fit into any kind of category what looked like the answer they were looking for. Now, does that not sound like our lives? The answer that I'm looking for from God looks like this, and so I keep looking for that. And then God says, that's not the answer that I have. The answer I have for you looks like this. And this is a huge spiritual principle. Most of the time, I know exactly what God's answer ought to look like. And it's not this. And God says, no. My answer looks like this. You know, and I'm like, you know, no, the answer looks like this. This works out much better. This makes sense. This works. And it's like, no, this is what my answer looks like. It is so counterintuitive. So I want to ask you, what's your quick fix this morning? There's a number of ways you can practically think about this. If you're single, you know, it's really hard to believe God, isn't it? Christmas means you can say no to the quick fix and never settle until God brings his victory into your life. What is it in your life that's hard to believe God for? What is it? What God is saying is that I am sufficient for that issue in your life. Listen to Philippians 4:19. My God will supply every need of yours according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. And let me just tell you about an event in my own life where, you know, for years I prayed for my future spouse. This was back when I was single. And, you know, I didn't get married until I was 35. So it's like I got to think, you know, this may not happen for me. And, you know, and I think I just stopped praying about it. I gave up. And that I never give up on anything. And I just thought, well, if it's gonna, I guess I became really Calvinistic about it. I just figured, well, if it's gonna happen, it's gonna happen, right? And then Julie happened. And that was something that I never anticipated that. Right? Haven't you defined, like, if you're single, you know, this, my spouse is going to be this, that, and the other, and then God said, you know, that's just not going to do. It looks like this. And I never dreamed it was going to be like that. Well, I'm glad that God was gracious to me, even when I just had virtually given up. He was gracious to me. And I got God's answer for this. And you know what? I don't recommend this, but it was like I just stood there and I did nothing. I got to that point where I just didn't do anything because nothing I did worked. This was before eHarmony. You know, no online dating sites. You had to go to like singles Bible studies or singles ministries there was nothing like that. And so I gave up. I kind of forced to give up, and then God did it. I want you to think about this. You know, the solutions that we form in our heads of what something ought to look like. Do you think for a moment that when Jesus was hanging on a cross, in that moment, that the Jewish people were looking at it and saying, that's the answer right there. Boy, I'm glad. This is it. When they saw that on the cross, they're like, what is this? This is no answer. How can this person in his weakness be a savior? How can God come and meet my needs in my life? The cross, Jesus hanging there in that moment was meeting your need. What was your need? He was slaying the dragon of sin and death. That was your greatest need. Whatever you thought your greatest need was at that moment, which was really hurting your heart, you know what the greatest need was? Jesus, in all of his weakness, masked all the power underneath of him slaying at that moment the sin and the death that was taking you down. Christmas means believing God, his solution. It means saying no to all the quick fixes that we can think of that seem to really mean like, oh, it should be like this. And God says, no. It looks like this. I want you to think about it. Just consider it, that God's solution may be very different than what you are anticipating it looking like. And Christmas means believing in God. All right, thirdly, Christmas means coming into God's presence. You know, the child in Isaiah 7:14 is called Emmanuel. Now, you know this. It's the Hebrew for God with us, you know, Emmanuel. Emmanuel with us, El, God, God with us. That's how Jesus was named, God with us. Now, for Ahaz, that was not the sign that he was looking for. That was God's sign he picked for him. And I didn't know this until I was studying it this week, that it talks about, you know, before the child is old enough to, you know, when he's eating curds and honey. And I thought, that's such a lovely image, that is, curds and honey. Do you know, curds and honey was the food that was eaten during a famine. This sign that Ahaz didn't really like was a sign of comfort to Israel because of the future devastation that they were going to go through from Assyria. And God is saying, I am with you. I will be with you. They went into captivity because a king wouldn't ask for a sign. And then the sign that they got was God speaking to believers saying, I will be with you even through that. Verse 18, God whistles for Assyria to swarm over the land, like for flies, for dogs to come in and eat. And he just whistles, you know, like this, and then these fly, they just come in like flies and swarm over Israel. The sign of God being with his people is given as a comfort, but it wasn't a comfort for Ahaz. You know, God's presence is a great comfort for people. It's a great assurance. I'm going to talk to you about this. It's like fire, God's presence is. You know, fire has an attracting quality, and it has a repulsive quality. Everyone loves a good fire. You love to gather up to it, you know, like play in the fire. Unless you live in Tennessee, and then you're running from the fire because it's burning the hills alive. Well, all the way back in 1959, R.C. Sproul began to think about the holiness of God. R.C. Sproul, he's a pastor, teacher in our extended church. And R.C. Sproul started thinking about the holiness of God in 1959, and what got him to think about this was a book that was written by a German theologian whose name was Rudolf Otto. And he wrote a book called The Idea of the Holy. And through Rudolf Otto's study, he came to the conclusion that men and women in all religions all experienced a similar phenomenon when they came into the presence of the supernatural. And it was, they were drawn to this, but they were also terrified. It was like this, you're drawn, but you're repulsed at the same time. You're like this, but it's like, you know, it's like magnets. You turn them one way and they're drawn to each other. You turn them the other way and they're repulsed. What Rudolf Otto said in The Idea of the Holy, he said, when they get into the presence of the supernatural, they have this reaction. On one hand, there's this attraction, and on the other hand, there's a repulsion. On the one hand, they're attracted, but on the other hand, they're terrified. And I heard one time R.C. Sproul speak on this in person. He said, you know, you remember that time when the disciples were fishing, you know, and they threw Jesus directs them to, you know, throw the net over, you know, one side of the boat, and they do that, and then there's a haul of fish. It's like, 169 fish or 150. I can't remember the exact number. And he said, now you would have expected this reaction, which would have been, you know, Peter's in the boat, and he sees this. He's a professional fisherman. And as R.C. explains it, he says, you know, I would be thinking he would be, you know, jamming his hand down into his pocket, ripping through his pocket to find a piece of paper, pull it out, and sign Jesus on a contract, you know, because I want this guy for my fishing operation. He said, instead, Peter is falling down, and he is saying, instead, depart from me. I am a sinful man. Now, all Jesus did was just tell him where to find the fish. Peter recognized that this control over the water, this is deity, that he's in the presence of holiness. And Peter, the first thing he says is that, depart from me, I'm a sinful person. Now, here's the question. Now, what does this have to do with Emmanuel, God with us? how can it be that you could bring the presence of God close without running from it? Now you think about that. How could God come without you running from him in all of his holiness? Well, how did Emmanuel come? How did he come? He was little. He was an infant. He was small. You could carry God in your arms. Now that's how it happens. He came, he condescended in such a way that what God would you ever think of coming in the person of a little baby that you would carry around? And now think forward as vulnerable and condescending as this. Well, what's the next major image that you think of this great God? Hanging on a cross, being taunted, bloodied, whipped, punched, beaten, not to be feared, right? Completely vulnerable. Think of how he starts his life, completely vulnerable. Think how he ends his life, completely vulnerable. Why does he do that? Jesus comes and makes himself so completely vulnerable and small. God with us, he allows us to come into his presence, and he culminates on a cross in the most vulnerable position. Why? Because he is being crucified and he is being punished in our place. He loses the presence of God so that he can bring us into the presence of God by taking our sin. Jesus came, God with us, so that in a moment of seeming defeat and weakness on a cross, Jesus looking like he was defeated, God was slaying our sin and taking our death. We could be brought into the very presence of God's holiness so that we could have God with us. Jesus lost the Father's presence so we could have it. And so Christmas means connecting to the presence of God. When God condescended, coming as a baby, completely vulnerable, and then completely weak on a cross. God with us, Emmanuel. All right, we're going to pray. And we're going to take the, we're going to have, well,